Hello, and welcome to another episode of Banking on Information. Today, my guest is Alexander Addario, who is a market manager, fintech at SVB. Alexander, welcome to the podcast.
Super excited to be here. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about fintech and what we do over here.
Now, we always start with that same question for everyone, so I have it for you too. Alexander, why do you do what you do?
It's a great question. I'm glad you start with that on all these interviews. I don't think people ask each other themselves that question enough, but if I really think back, I've been in financial services for 15 years at banks the entire time. But when I think of the root of why I do what I do, it really started in my childhood. I grew up in a household where financial services and discussing financial engineering was part of dinner table conversation. So I just always grew up curious about financial services due to my father and my grandfathers and kind of family history in financial services. So I was always just intellectually curious about financial services. So I've worked in banks my entire career, always in credit in some way, shape, or form. And I've been at SVB now for 7 years. Really, what makes it so fun for me is what I do today is a culmination of 15 years plus what my family was doing really in the past, which ultimately makes the job fun at the end of the day, which I hope most people can say in their jobs, but I feel very lucky to say that, frankly.
That's very interesting. So you actually have banking heritage. You grew up in a family where banking was a thing. You discussed it. So very interesting how that drives why you do what you do.
I would also say, besides my family background, it's really because I'm so interested in financial services, banks aren't always the most innovative part of the economy. ACH APIs are a big innovation in the last 10 years. Money movement is still super archaic. So I think for me, ultimately, also like why I do what I do at SVB specifically, I get to work with financial services companies that are innovating every single day. I get to solve hard problems in financial services through the portfolio companies that I work with. So that's what really makes it exciting. So it's like there's a aspect of me that's just intellectually curious about this. So that's why I enjoy what I do so much today and why I do it. It's like I get to work with companies that are disrupting financial services every day, which is hard and challenging. And to do it right, I think you really have to be intellectually curious about it.
So you really enjoy that innovation in financial services. And I think you're in the right spot to do that. Now, what would you say is the sort of number one use case that SVB solves for? What do you do?
I mean, I'll speak to fintech at SVB specifically. I mean, whether you knew or didn't know SVB before 2023, most people know SVB now for different reasons. But SVB has been servicing the innovation economy for 40 plus years, providing financing, banking, all sorts of things. We have a wine division that's like the biggest financing arm in the Napa Valley for vineyards. It's like anything kind of associated with the VC ecosystem, SVB really has an arm to it. What we're most known for kind of day-to-day is venture debt. Interesting enough, it's a relatively small portion of our entire debt portfolio or lending portfolio, but it's what we're most known for and what we're most flexible on. But my team primarily focuses on fintech and financial services, and that really means venture debt as well, but also banking, including crypto companies, warehouse financing, so financing assets and loan receivables, payment solutions for fintech companies. And really the special sauce of what we do on my team and what we solve for our companies is we're one united team that does fintech across all those verticals. Most financial services firms, including everywhere that I've worked for, are very siloed in these different divisions. We actually have one centralized fintech team to help companies with specialists at every given part, but one team, one P&L, one leadership group, which actually makes it pretty unique. And part of why I love this is really what we offer companies is one-stop shop across so many different verticals of fintech that normally you would have to go to 4 or 5 different providers to actually do all this in one place.
So you help fintechs be successful in many ways, but venture debt being one of them. Obviously, for those who don't remember SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, the heart of where a lot of fintechs, a lot of startups actually start in Silicon Valley. So you do have a long history there helping them. Now, maybe just shortly, what venture debt is? How's that different from VCs? VCs putting money into startups?
That's a fantastic question. Just venture debt's a relatively new asset class, as is venture capital in general in the history of finance, obviously. But venture debt is really a derivative of venture capital. So where at its core, where a VC firm at Series A will find a company that's innovative, that has a significant addressable market that they feel that can, with VC capital, grow meaningfully. Most companies aren't VC backed, and most companies shouldn't be. Most companies shouldn't be trying to capture a market opportunity as quickly as possible by burning cash. But where VCs find those opportunities, they inject typically about 18 months of capital into a company at any given round. Venture debt's really an add-on. Now, there's different flavors of venture debt. There's a kind of Series A venture debt, which is an add-on. You might add 2 to 3 quarters of runway to a company. So if a VC syndicate puts in money to give someone 18 months to achieve a certain milestone, I'll kind of keep it to fintech. Let's say, like, roll out their new card product and get a warehouse facility and get their first couple cohorts of clients such that they could then raise a Series B. Venture debt allows you to basically have 2 to 3 more quarters of runway before you have to go out and raise around. Mistakes happen and issues happen in startups. It allows you to iterate. For financial services, your licenses take longer. It takes longer to close your warehouse facility. A regulator comes in and asks you a bunch of questions that you weren't prepared for. Having flexibility is really helpful. So venture debt gives you flexibility. It is debt. You know, it is first lien. It's first preference on the way out in the downside scenario or in a sale. But ultimately, it's very flexible. It's typically structured without financial covenants, which allows companies to effectively use it like equity. It's not equity, but like you can effectively use it like equity. And if you've raised, you know, $10 million round, you might be able to add, say, $2, $3, $4 million of venture debt to basically make your runway $14 million of capital, which really, really just gives flexibility. There's interest associated with it, repayment terms. There's typically a warrant component, but that warrant component is really, really small from a cost of capital perspective. So surely an efficiency, cost of capital, and flexibility play. That changes over time. You can do venture debt at later stages to avoid raising equity and to go to IPO or to go to a sale or to go to cash flow. So it's a broad gamut, but the classic venture debt Series A model is really an add-on.
That's super helpful. Thank you for clarifying that. Now, how do your customers talk about the value they get from working with you?
So I talked about the traditional one, at least on the venture debt side, like extending runway, right? It can be very helpful for companies. Sometimes companies talk about it as an insurance policy, just getting a little bit more flexibility. The cost is not too high. But it's critical when companies are going through inflection points and need a little bit more time. There's plenty of examples there. I'll actually use one that's interesting from a fintech perspective, but we have a client that raised a bunch of money, Series B equity perspective. They had launched a card program, but had not yet lined up a warehouse facility. They started originating assets. Their product became really popular with their clients. So they actually started using a bunch of equity to finance their originations. That is not a sustainable or cost efficient, you know, from a cost of equity perspective, way to finance loan receivables. We actually helped them do a warehouse facility, but warehouse facilities can take 6 months to put in place. So we actually gave them venture debt to effectively bridge them to our own warehouse facility. So a really good example of like finding a specific use case, a need, and solving it at a relatively low cost of capital. And then they raised their warehouse facility, which unlocked a bunch of capital again. And the venture debt kind of flipped to just being traditional runway extension for operating purposes. One of the stories I'm probably most proud of is actually a company that is a payroll company, very, very successful payroll company nowadays. When they were younger, they actually had a processing partner that ended up going bankrupt due to fraud. It's a payroll company that, due to their underlying processor, could not do payroll. You can imagine like enterprise value goes out the window completely. They came to us as their actually venture debt provider at the time, and two other major financial institutions, top three financial institutions in the country, and asked, like, we need to get ACH rolling, like just basic ACH, but we need to get ACH rolling this weekend. The two other banks said, we'll give you a 1 month SLA. Like, sure, we'll do it for you, but like, it'll take about a month. We actually did it over the weekend. Now, we did have a slight incentive that we had a bunch of venture debt out to them. So like we understood why it was so important. It was also important to retaining enterprise value for our own risk. But we actually got it done over the weekend. We just dropped everything else when it came to ACH processing over that weekend. Yeah, ACH processing has started to be over the weekend recently, but it's typically not something that's done on the weekend anyway. So our operations and IT teams and development teams just worked all weekend with them. There were like literally 24/7 calls with their management team, and we got it done. And they were processing payroll about a week later, didn't miss many payroll windows and kept going. So that type of thing is really difficult to orchestrate at financial institutions, given the number of different groups involved. And having a centralized group that does that is super helpful. And having aligned incentives. Hey, this my venture debt's going to go to zero. If we don't figure this out, like it's and some of the banks I've worked at before would be impossible to orchestrate. Those are just some fintech-specific examples of really just adding value, whether it's payments, warehouse financing, or venture debt, where it's really not just banking.
That sounds very customer-focused and great that you were able to jump in there and do that over the weekend. Now, I like to do this thing called futures thinking. So we don't know what the future is going to hold, but let's think 10 years out what a possible future could look like. So if you envision that 10 years from now, 2035, what do you think the startup fintech landscape is going to look like?
I'm fascinated with financial services based on everything I've shared. I am a credit guy at heart, though, so like I am not good at this. My crystal ball is not great. But I will say it's hard not to talk about AI and crypto right now in financial services. AI, very early innings in financial services. You see how in the VC ecosystem, half the rounds right now are driven by AI. That's something like 14% for fintechs, last I looked, in the last like couple of months. So it's really early innings. There's a lot of efficiency tools, a lot of underwriting tools, et cetera, that all could use AI for fintech. As a consumer, are you okay with a claims adjustment being done by a machine, by an AI, versus a human being? I think I'd have a hard time. And I'm someone that's on the kind of forefront of working with innovative companies. I think between consumer behavior and regulation, it'll take a while for AI. But given the massive amount of inefficiencies and archaic rails in financial services, I do think AI over the next 10 years will revolutionize how money moves, fairness and lending, all sorts of different things that will be super interesting. I think you pair that with crypto, where it kind of goes back a little bit to just how archaic. There's 9,000 financial institutions just in the U.S. You know, I'm not a big meme coin or NFT person personally. You know, we do have a crypto team. They love those things more than I do. But I do really think the underlying tech, clarity, speed, execution of crypto really and stable coins will really revolutionize how financial services work over the next 10 years. And I think as regulatory clarity comes to both those places, it'll just increase that innovation even more. So personally, I think those two things will drive a ton of change the next 10 years, ultimately for the positive of consumers.
That is going to be very interesting to see how that combination of crypto and AI, how that's going to drive lots of efficiency. So I love where you're going with that. With your crystal ball is actually pretty good with that. I can see that being very important in the next 10 years. Now, what can we do today to get ready for that possible future?
That's a great question. Banks really need to be at a highest leadership level, embracing like AI strategy and crypto strategy. I think over the last 2 years, kind of before 2025, I think many banks were shying away from crypto. I think now you see the Circle IPO, you see everything that's going on from a regulatory perspective. And I'm not saying, hey, dive head first and you should be capturing it all because of behind. It's really more about creating a strategy around how we're going to use this. Where are the use cases that are applicable and low-hanging fruit? I think about ingesting financial data. Just in the technology bank within SVB, we have about 18,000 tech clients, and thousands of those send financial reporting to us every single month. Every single one of them sends financial reporting in their own special pebble of a way, right? These are not 10 Qs and 10 Ks that are standardized by the SEC. Just automating that, allowing us to actually standardize the data, automate it, and then actually spend more time analyzing and driving insights instead of spending time just doing data entry. Those are low-hanging fruit use cases to AI and crypto and other ways that banks would really start implementing today. And there are fintechs starting to build this type of tech. So I really think that's the type of stuff that you can do today to embrace it, dip your toes in the space, and then start to think about how do I automate underwriting, et cetera. Those are things that I think will take a lot of time, regulatory and also consumer behavior changes. But there are so many efficient things that can be done today with tech that already exists. Banks just need to start embracing creating a crypto and AI strategy around how they're going to embrace this stuff over the next 10 years.
That's probably also a good point to wrap this up. So people get in the game, both on AI as well as crypto. It's here to stay. So even if you're not there yet to fully dive in, you got to get ready and get in the game. Thank you so much, Alexander, for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
And until next time, choose to be curious.